They'll tell it like it is, not holding back when it comes to informing you of the truth. I'll also give you my perspective from experience as a former practicing attorney, licensed psychotherapist, and frequent guest on radio and TV. So won't you join me every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM, where I'll bring you more truth without all the hype that others want you to hear. See you then.
This is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food, and you're listening to PRN, your source for progressive, up-to-date, and inspirational information on nutrition and health. Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you on board today. We're going to talk about how meditation can help you with anxiety and depression and pain. Who says? John Hopkins University says, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Mainstream has finally caught up to what a lot of people have been doing for years. Also, the loving touch of a mother is critical for premature infants. A Bar Ilam University in Israel tells you about why that skin-to-skin contact is so important. And the University of Eastern Finland and Karolinska Institute say several forms of vitamin E protect against memory disorders. That's important. And University of Exeter Medical School in the United Kingdom says green spaces, there's your trees and shrubs, deliver lasting mental health benefits and a lot more. Also today from our segment dealing with audio clips, we have several and a wide variety of topics. For example, we're going to talk about one on Big Pharma. It turns out that there was a non-toxic cancer treatment that was able to cure all types of cancer, and no one was interested. Why not? Could it have been that they couldn't patent it? We'll play the news clip. Then Monsanto's weed killer is found in a lot of different products that people don't know it's there. We'll give you the latest on that and why you should be concerned about Roundup. And then for those who still believe, the mainstream media, that it was Assad, the president of Syria, who, engaging against his own people, decided to kill them. Well, A, that held no water, didn't hold any water before, and it doesn't now. Who says? A United Nations special inspector who went there and said these chemical weapons, they were not made or used by Assad or the Syrian regime, they were used by the rebels. You'll hear that from them, but you haven't heard that in the mainstream media. So we have a lot to share today from a lot of different perspectives, including when we talk about fake news. Who are the greatest purveyor of fake news? The CIA. Well, who says? How about the director of the CIA and the news director of a major network who work with the CIA? Can we prove it? Yeah, we have them on camera saying it. Under oath in one case. So they admit it. Yeah, they admit it. And it's widespread. It's everywhere. Then why are we considering someone mentioning how the government propagandizes issues and uses the different media outlets, both on the right and left, to, in effect, to manipulate public? Because we don't want to know the truth. Also today, I will be sharing a commentary on what we can reasonably expect from this president, the promises he has made to his base, and what he's actually done. How dangerous is he? Well, a lot more dangerous than what people might assume. And it's not just me saying that. We're going to go to Stanford University. We're going to review what Chauncey D. DeVega has to say about a professor from Stanford who run the most famous and scary psychology experiment in history, and he put Trump on the couch for us. I won't tell you now what he said. It'll come a little later. My guest in the second part of our program will be a real eye-opener. We're going to talk about the new Cold War and nuclear arms race. Professor Peter Kuznick, he is a professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C., where he also serves as the director of the university's Nuclear Studies Institute. And he specializes in American political history and the history of nuclear weapons in the Cold War. And he is also co-author with Academy Award-winning director Oliver Stone of the New York Times bestseller, The Untold History of the United States. So we're going to find out about this whole idea that Trump is not just embracing what Obama and Clinton both gave him, $1 trillion to spend on new forms of nuclear weapons. What about the 7,000 ones we have? Well, knowing Trump, he'll try to find some way of using them. So we have to be very concerned about this guy and the people around him and the amount of money they're going to spend and which countries they're going to put these nukes and what could possibly go wrong. You see, we have a packed show today, as we do every day. I always like to start, however, on a topic that all of us can agree we need more of, and that is health. From Johns Hopkins University, an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association reviewed the entire body of scientific evidence on relaxation programs involving meditation. And they found that they do indeed benefit people with medical conditions and are particularly good against depression. In fact, similar in benefit to those taking antidepressive drugs. Hold on a second. There should be a disclaimer there. If you're telling me that meditation does the same as antidepressive drugs, look at the medical insert into your meditation kit. Oh, I forgot there is none. Where the side effects that you take the drug could be depression as a side effect for treating depression, suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts. In fact, there's an entire page of side effects. So if I had a choice of benefiting from something that had no side effects and something that did, if they both worked the same, that should have been in Johns Hopkins University's article. And it wasn't. But at least they told us how good meditation is. And for that, we are appreciative. It also showed that meditation can give you a sense of well-being. It is a very important mental component of health-related quality of life. You have better attention, and you have better health-affected behavior, better sleep, better eating habits, and better weight control when you're meditating. None of the above applies to tranquilizers. From Bar Ilan University in Israel, a study on touch, in particular and specifically, the benefit that premature infants gain from skin contact with their mothers is measurable even 10 years after birth. That's according to a new study published in Biological Psychiatry. Let's put this into proper and more human context. Physical contact with babies is essential for their physical and psychological development. Now, this lesson has been learned the hard way, as infants neglected in hospitals and orphanages develop many problems, ranging from depression to a more global failure to thrive. But what types of contact are necessary, and what are the benefits to enriching a person from that physical contact? Well, in a new study, Dr. Ruth Feldman, professor at the university, and her colleagues studied the impact of different levels of physical contact on prematurely born infants. Quote, "In this decade-long study, we show for the first time that providing maternal newborn skin-to-skin contact to premature infants in the neonatal period improves children's functioning 10 years later in systems shown to be sensitive to early maternal deprivation in their research. Specifically, researchers compared standard incubator care to a novel intervention called kangaroo care, which was originally developed to manage the risk of hyperthermia in prematurely born babies in Colombia, where they struggle with a lack of access to incubators. And this method, in essence, uses the mother's body heat to keep their babies warm. And so they had 73 mothers provide skin-to-skin contact to their premature infants in the neonatal unit for 1 hour daily for 14 consecutive days. And for comparison, the researchers also assessed 73 premature infants who received standard incubator care. Children were then followed seven times over 10 years. And they found that during the first half year of life, mothers in the that were giving the skin-to-skin contact had better behavior in their infants. So nothing like breastfeeding and just hugging and loving your baby. University of Eastern Finland published an article in Experimental Gerontology that showed that as you get older, at let's say over the age of 40, you really need to look at your nutrient profile. And one of those nutrients is vitamin E. And if you take vitamin E on a daily basis, you're less likely to suffer from memory disorders than peers who didn't take their vitamin E. That's according to researchers. So vitamin E was seen to play a major role in the memory process. That's good. So take your vitamin E each day. The tocotrienols, that's T-O-C-O-T-R-I-E-L-S, tocotrienols, and tocopherols, T-O-C-O-P-H-E-R-O-L-S. That's your two different fractions, representing a total of 8 different forms of vitamin E. They all work synergistically in the body. I suggest about 400 units twice a day. And this is a part of a study entitled Cardiovascular Risk Factors, Aging, and Dementia. And from the University of Exeter Medical School, published in Environmental Science and Technology, they found that green spaces, wonderful places where there's trees and grass, lawns, both in cities and in towns and suburbs, could lead to significant and sustained improvements in mental health. They analyzed data that followed people over a 5-year period, and the researchers found that moving to a greener area not only improves your mental health, but also has an effect that continues long after that. So just spend time each day being in parks, gardens, because it can deliver some really powerful benefits that you need. And also, another study found that turmeric, turmeric, and myrrh, M-Y-R-H-H, protect against lead toxicity. This is from Alexandria University in Egypt. We know that lead is a ubiquitous industrial chemical and a potent neurotoxin. And as such, lead toxicity remains a major health concern worldwide. Fortunately, research suggests that turmeric root and myrrh can significantly mitigate lead's toxicity in the body. In this study conducted by researchers from Alexandria University Research Development in Egypt and published in the journal Basic and Clinical Pharmacology and Toxicology, mice were divided into 5 separate groups, and then at the end they found that those that got the turmeric and the myrrh had substantially less damage from lead. So that's good news. And we're always happy to share with you information that can, if you choose, can change the quality of a problem, turn it into something positive. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to go to other issues a little sooner than normal on our program day because I got a lot to share with you, but I just call out the scientists who joined my brother Stephen. I rarely, if ever, in fact, I don't ever share personal mail, but I want to share what my brother wrote me here He sent some photographs, and I'm going to post this. He's very shy, but he says, Gary, back but tired. He says, back from my mission from the Dominican Republic, attached two photographs of this team we had. Huge success due to enthusiasm of young Mercer College medical students and dedication and professionalism of Affinity and Aetna doctors. As you can see from the pictures, lots of diverse students were part of the team and first time in the Dominican Republic. Summary, two community clinics in one community and also an orphanage in the capital, private clinic near villages outside of San Pedro, and where families were of sugarcane workers live. 1,200 examinations of babies and young kids, full exams, hearing tests, eyes, motor skills, etc. Examined and worked with 286 pregnant women, 75 older adults showed up, all given vitamin supplements and all given free medicines as prescribed. Many thanks to all. Now, this is just the latest. My brother, Stephen, has been responsible for giving more than 80 million vitamins free to pregnant women in the Dominican Republic. He was also responsible for getting their first heart-lung machine, over $1 million machine for free, an ambulance. He has taken groups of doctors every year or so to the Dominican Republic to go to clinics and give free exams and medical treatment to the poor. He's done this about 70 times. He also was responsible for getting India, the entire country of India, to give up on lead in gasoline and get people to open up, the doctors to open up chelation clinics to take the lead out of children's bodies. And lead is a extreme neurotoxin, but also chelation therapy is not only known and approved by the FDA for removing lead, it's one of the few things they will say chelation is good for. And so millions upon millions of people in India and in the Dominican Republic are healthier and alive today because my little brother has been out there helping them for decades. Well done, Steve, and all the team of doctors you got to go with you. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. From our environmental segment today, a massive Antarctica iceberg hangs by a thread, and it's signaling frightening possibilities of devastating sea level rise. That's according to EcoWatch. That's the actual headlines from their latest report. So what does this mean? Here is what Lorraine Chow has to say. The growing rift in Antarctica Peninsula has now lengthened to 110 miles, meaning that the Larsen Sea ice shelf is now connected to the main ice shelf by only a 12-mile thread. And the British Antarctica Survey determined that the crack has expanded by 50 miles since 2011. Quote, this is particularly hard to predict when it could occur, meaning breaking off. I'm quite surprised as to how long it is holding on. The rift or crack has continued to open and the berg continues to drift outward at a very consistent rate. Now, why is this important? Well, first of all, imagine you have a glass of ice water and you have ice cubes in it. Well, when the ice cubes melt, it does not increase the volume of the water in the glass. Therefore, this 3/4 mile deep, 300 yards wide, 110 mile long, a chunk of ice will not add measurably or at all to the water because it's already floating there. Here's the bad part, and this is really serious. When that breaks off, when this ice shelf breaks off, which is expected any day now, and it floats out into the ocean. That'll be the largest iceberg in history. This is about, maybe 10,000 times bigger than the iceberg that sunk the Titanic. This is huge. Imagine if you drove from New York to New Paltz, New York, from New York City to New Paltz. You could drive on this iceberg and still have room to spare. That's a big iceberg. But the iceberg is a buttress. It is what keeps the other glacier and the other ice from falling into the ocean. So when this iceberg cracks and breaks off, then that whole 110-mile and probably be 120-mile area will be holding nothing back. That means is that the ice that's there, that could be 2 miles thick, as it's warming from underneath and it's warming on top, it's going to start to break and fall into the ocean. And when that happens, yeah, then we will see increases in the water. Now, initially, it might be 4, 5, 6 inches across the whole ocean. And then bigger pieces fall in, and in warm weather it accelerates. And then gravitational pull, depending upon the degree of slant going in, it'll get more and more and more. And then it'll just be in chaos. You'll have a feedback loop. And then we'll witness something that a lot of people have been concerned about. What happens when the oceans rise? Now, here's the problem. If you live in many areas of the world today, such as in Bangkok, if you live in much of Bangladesh and much of near the Indian Ocean and on the east coast of the United States, if you live down in the Florida Keys like Key Largo, you already have, with no storm surge at all, no storms, no hurricanes, just the nightly tides coming in, you have water increasing in some places as much as 18 inches standing in the streets in the morning. And that draws mosquitoes and stench. And I've been there. I lived in South Beach for 15 years. In fact, I just sold my place 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And at night, when I would go for a long walk, I used to walk over to Alton Road. It's only about 8 blocks wide. And then I'd walk up to Lincoln Road and then just enjoy one, in my opinion, one of the nicest streets in America, Lincoln Road. Beautifully done with all kinds of tropical growths and palm trees and restaurants, theaters, stores. But people just lounging casually and enjoying life. Now, you can't do that. When you go over to Alton Road almost every night, it's flooded. Now, the city went through an emergency program and put in these giant pumps. So they put in, I think, $226 million with these pumps. So when the tide rises at night, again, we're not talking about a storm. We're talking about the tides. So every 24 hours, the tide comes in, and it's coming in further and further and further and higher. And it was putting a foot or more of water on the entire length of Alton Road. And now they're pumping it back out into the bay. Well, what's wrong with that? The bay is connected to the Atlantic Ocean. So you're not getting rid of the water. It's going right back and coming back in again. So you can mark off South Beach, Miami Beach, the whole East Coast beaches, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach, they're all going to be partially inundated. Now, let's not parse our words here. I'm not saying devastated. I'm not saying cataclysmic. I'm not saying unlivable. I'm saying that when water comes in, and it comes in further and further every night, it has no place to go, and a lot of it's going to go down into the sand. Every one of those buildings are built on sand with these concrete stanchions that rest down on sand. So as the concrete is impacted at the base, where water is pulling against it, you'll start seeing cracks in the building. And that means in time, a lot of those buildings will be condemned. They will be unsuitable or unsafe for living. And then sidewalks will begin to collapse. Some parking areas near the beach will begin to collapse. And then the salt water coming in will start to destroy the palm trees that can't thrive with salt water. They die with salt water. But when the salt water comes in at night in the hot tide, it's going right up to the palm trees. The palm trees need fresh water, not salt water. So the root system's going to rot. So you're going to have all these tens of thousands of dead palm trees up and down the beaches. Tens of thousands of dwellings will be adversely affected. But then think of all the agriculture that is up and down the thin area of the Florida Keys and further north in Homestead. That requires regular water, rainwater, potable water, underground aquifer. But as the water comes in from the tide, the salt water goes down and creates a saline or salt water. That will kill virtually all plants. So that's not happening in the future. That's been happening for the last 5 years. It's accelerating. Now then along comes a storm, and that storm is even worse. The storm brings massive amounts of water in, way further than what it would have otherwise. And because they destroyed all the barrier islands, then there's nothing standing between the ocean and its fury and land. So we're going to see worse storms, greater velocity storms, higher waves, more disaster, more trouble. So you might live in a 20-story skyscraper overlooking the ocean, but that skyscraper can be impacted by just 1 foot increase in sea level. That's because that building rests on sand. And all over the world, where buildings were done at sea level, they're now being structurally challenged by the ocean coming in and higher tides at night. So that's why that iceberg, the Larsen B shelf, breaking off, I'm guessing in the next month or two at the most, that'll release massive amounts, gigatons of ice going into the ocean, because there's nothing there to backstop it. There's nothing there as a barrier. And then it creates a feedback loop. The more that comes off, the more that is, the greater the surge and the greater the gravitational pull to bring even more off. That's a problem. So just some things that we should think about. I want to share something with you. I believe that many people who are liberal, but in the liberal tradition of an FDR, are concerned about what people are doing with the so-called label of liberal today. They're looking at people becoming more neoliberal. So let's finish off today with what has happened to the liberal community. Please listen in.
You're not going to believe this, but we have to talk about the regressive left today. I've actually been trying to get away from discussing the regressive left lately and instead talk about the ideas of classical liberalism, which I believe in, but current events keep dragging me back. I see on social media that people are using the phrase regressive left a bit less lately and replacing it with terms like bigoteer, the control left, or the illiberal left. Whatever name you use for this well-meaning yet painfully misguided set of ideas is largely irrelevant. We needed this phrase to identify this backwards ideology which puts groups before people, and sometimes you need a label to get people to understand an idea. The portion of the left which is no longer progressive, meaning for progress, but regressive, meaning going backwards, has been identified, and now we're clearly bringing people to the side of reason. All of you who talk about this with friends and family, who use the regressive left hashtag on Twitter, and share these videos are part of this political awakening. Yes, it seems like these backwards ideas are getting stronger in some circles, but at the same time, finally, for the first time in a long time, those of us who are liberal and open to new ideas are coming together and being heard. Whether or not you like Trump, his win was a huge rejection of the identity politics of the left. But don't take my word for that. Bernie Sanders said it himself. The only thing which can replace the regressive descent of the left is a return to true liberalism. A liberalism which defends free speech and expression, a liberalism that is for liberty and rights of the individual, and most importantly, a liberalism that is one for human liberty. I now believe that this regressive ideology is the biggest threat to freedom and Western civilization that exists today. With the rise of Trump and the constant comparisons they make of him to Hitler, the left now has the perfect boogeyman to use to excuse anything. If your opponent is a vile racist, then you can use violence and any means necessary to stop him. The regressive left has already begun using violence as a tactic, and I fear that that's just getting started. If you're only now getting up to speed on what the regressive left is, allow me to recap quickly. The regressive, control, illiberal left, whatever you want to call it, is a group of people who place identity, usually based on immutable characteristics, in a pecking order of social importance such as race, gender, and religion, where victimhood is the highest virtue to be had. This oppression Olympics allows groups to compete for who is the most oppressed, thus the most virtuous. And if someone isn't as oppressed as you, then you have full authority to oppress them accordingly. So Black Lives Matter can protest a gay rights march in Toronto. White gay men can be banned from leading LGBT organizations on college campuses. Pro-life women can be kicked out of women's rights marches, and so on. This backwards ideology, which demands we judge each other not on the content of our character, but on the color of our skin or some other baked-in trait, puts the collective ahead of the individual. It loves all of its minority groups to behave as monoliths, so if you're a true individual, meaning you don't subscribe to the ideas that the groupthink has attributed to you based on those immutable characteristics, you must be cast out. Many of the guests on my show have suffered from this backwards backlash. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Majid Nawaz, Sarah Hader, and Ali Rizvi all have felt abandoned by the left because they speak out about the problems within Islam. They dare to fight for a more tolerant, more truly progressive Islam in tune with a modern society and basic liberal values, and for that they're labeled bigots or worse. The Southern Poverty Law Center even labeled Majid as an anti-Muslim extremist. In reality, Majid's a former Islamist who has devoted his life to trying to reform Islam from the inside, to try to reconcile his faith with the modern world, fighting for gays and atheists and women and any other free thinkers living under theocratic rule. For this, he is called a porch monkey and other vile names by supposed progressives, while at the same time he's admired by many on the right for being outspoken. This is the absolute height of absurdity. But it all makes sense when you value groups over individuals. The individual must be sacrificed at the altar of the collective. So when any of these people dare speak out and call for true tolerance, they find their tolerance met with intolerance. The left loves diversity in skin color, just not diversity in thought. Of course, this regressive ideology isn't just tied to Islam at all. My guest this week is Larry Elder, a Black conservative who has had every label and smear thrown at him. Again, like with the previous guests I just mentioned, these slurs come from people on the left who would rather silence and dismiss their opponents than actually engage them in an honest way. People often ask me which interview I've done that's changed my views the most, and I almost always say that it was the first time I sat down with Larry Elder. He challenged my views on systemic racism, as well as the need for a strong family, and was one of the people that helped sell me on why small government is important. If you haven't seen the video, we'll post the link right down below. Larry challenged me, and I wasn't ready, so I can't say that it was my best moment on camera, but I listened and learned, and just as importantly, we didn't edit any of it out. So I'm looking forward to picking up where Larry ended up.
We're going out now to Washington, D.C., where standing by is Professor Peter Kuznick. That's K-U-Z-N-I-C-K. He is a professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C., where he also serves as director of the university's Nuclear Studies Institute. And as I mentioned at the beginning of our program, he is also an author, and he is also working with Oliver Stone. Together they wrote The Untold History of the United States. And he's very concerned about what a president like Trump could do with an expanded nuclear arsenal and posturing against people that Trump personally believes represent an existential threat to the United States. Nice to have you with us today.
Glad to be here, Gary.
We need to probably go back to the Obama administration to better understand Trump's current intention to renew a Cold War with Russia and other nuclear countries outside of the Washington consensus. Obama increased our budget for developing and revamping our nuclear program by $1 trillion. Now, you know that in Washington, every budget that is submitted and approved ultimately goes anywhere from 20 to 200% above that. We were told it was to modernize our nuclear bombs, and Trump inherited this from Obama. Also, a part of Obama's plan was to develop low-yield precision-guided nuclear warheads, which would seem to be for the sole intention of actually engaging in a nuclear conflict rather than deterring us from one. And these would be used to arm our ships, planes, submarines, essentially restock our military machinery with nuclear war capabilities. So please begin by explaining how this strategy is designed to use weapons more than deter their use, because Trump has stated that what is the use of nuclear weapons if you don't use them? You've noted he even entertained the idea of nuking ISIS. The forum is yours.
Well, you touched on a lot of very important points that we can talk some more about. Obama is quite baffling. He's an enigma in a lot of ways. Perhaps the high point of his presidency came in spring of 2009 when he made his anti-nuclear speech in Prague. He called for the global abolition of nuclear weapons. The speech was considered visionary at the time, and it really catapulted him toward the Nobel Peace Prize, which he won the following year. But if you read that speech very, very carefully, there were indications there that Obama was not going to seriously act on his nuclear views. Some of us took them quite seriously because Obama had been espousing those kinds of ideas since the early 1980s. Obama participated in the 1982 Central Park March against nuclear weapons that was attended by a million people. Obama had written about that as an undergraduate at Columbia. And so we had some reason to take him seriously on this, but his actions over the next 8 years really betrayed that vision. And then he adopted a program which calling for, as you said, a $1 trillion modernization of our nuclear arsenal over a three-decade period. He wants to not only modernize, but make every weapon in the arsenal more usable. We've seen that game before. George W. Bush, if you go back to his 2002 Nuclear Posture Review, Bush was also talking about miniaturizing our nuclear arsenal, making those weapons more usable, trying to erase the line between conventional weapons and nuclear weapons, targeting non-nuclear nations. The New York Times had a quite prescient editorial called America, describing America as the world's nuclear rogue power. And it was appropriate given the stance that the Bush administration had adopted. But we all thought that once Bush was out of there and you had a more reasonable statesman like Obama in there, that he would act in a more prudent way. Well, maybe he would be less trigger happy in terms of using that nuclear arsenal, but he's handing this modernized, more usable nuclear arsenal off to the Donald Trumps of the world and future presidents. So Obama's behavior there, I think, is quite reckless, irresponsible, and in some ways baffling.
Okay. Not too long ago,
the bulletin of at Trump's views, as you suggested, Trump is unlike Obama. He's more rash. He's more impulsive. He's more shallow, has little, if any, strategic vision, has no understanding of how one crisis might affect another crisis, is capable of flipping his views 180 degrees on a moment's notice. And his comments about nuclear weapons, as you said, have been quite frightening. He did say, what's the point of having nuclear weapons if we can't use them? To reasonable people, they would conclude, so let's get rid of our nuclear weapons. To Trump, that means let's make our nuclear weapons more usable. He said that if ISIS attacks us, of course we're going to respond with nuclear weapons. What a moronic thing to say. ISIS doesn't have an address. Where are we going to hit them? He's said it's fine for Japan and South Korea and Saudi Arabia to develop their own nuclear arsenal. Goes against everything the United States has at least officially stood for decades. And one of the things that I found startling was when another deep thinker, Bobby Knight, the former Indiana University basketball coach, endorsed Trump. And he said, Harry Truman, with what he did in dropping and having the guts to drop the bomb in 1944, he's off by a year, saved millions of American lives. And that's what Harry Truman did. And he became one of the three great presidents of the United States. And here's a man, Donald Trump, who would do the same thing because he's going to become one of the four great presidents of the United States. And so Trump started saying that, correcting Knight's ignorance or his ludicrous views, gushes, such a great guy. Wow. How do you top that? You should be proud of him in Indiana. This is a national treasure, okay? So that was the exchange between these two geniuses, Trump and Bobby Knight. But that, it does reveal something about Trump's views, and that he takes pride in having the guts to drop atomic bombs. So now you've got a situation where you've got a standoff with two 12-year-olds playing nuclear chicken between Kim Jong-un in North Korea and Donald Trump, sending the carrier strike force toward Korea to see who's going to blink first. This is, you know, we're dealing with nuclear weapons. The United States and Russia have 93 to 94% of the world's nuclear arsenal. There are still approximately 15,000 nuclear weapons left in the world. The United States and Russia have 1,000 nuclear weapons pointed at each other on hair trigger alert, which means they can be instantaneously launched. And so we've got the tensions ratcheting up between the United States and Russia. As people are commenting, this is probably the low point since the Cuban Missile Crisis in terms of relations between our countries. And so you've got this kind of childhood bully mentality, playground mentality, operating in the leaders of certainly the United States and Korea. Putin has shown a little more restraint. But this is a very, very dangerous situation right now.
Peter, we should also consider the following. We're not dealing with the old Russia. We're dealing with one of the highest educated groups of people, professionals in the world. They've had a, though they've had sanctions, and though they've had the fall of the ruble, they did have about 7 years where they really prospered and were able to build up their economy. People who have gained something, a higher quality of life, don't entertain the idea of having destroyed. And when you're dealing with a person who has been down and out and has nothing to lose, they generally are not afraid to fight. You do not see this in Russia or China because they realize they don't want to undo what the last 20 years has been able to give them. So they would much prefer negotiating, even I would bet entertain the idea of accelerating a denuclearization program, providing that it was with all the people in the world getting rid of their nukes. That said, not long ago, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved to doomsday clock to 2.5 minutes to midnight, meaning we are at the brink of nuclear confrontation. And right now, the world's future is in the hands of, in effect, one guy, Donald Trump, with the others who are going to react, with the codes to launch nuclear war. What I don't hear being spoken about is what the consequences of a nuclear exchange would be today compared to when bombs were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And and our nuclear warheads are far more destructive today. So can you give us a little idea of how much more destructive these weapons are, or the new generation that they were praising and all excited by, Obama and Clinton? She would have done the same thing if she were president, when she's praising and they're praising these warheads being developed and their capabilities.
Yeah, right now so we've got approximately 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world. At the peak in the mid-1980s, we had about 70,000 nuclear weapons. I take students every summer on a study abroad class in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Kyoto. And I found myself copying down every year in the Atomic Bomb Museum in Hiroshima the same wording in this exhibit. And because it said that by 1985, the world had accumulated the equivalent of 1.47 million Hiroshima bombs. What are we going to do with 1.47 million Hiroshima bombs? It was truly insane. But that was the period in the mid-80s when Carl Sagan and other scientists were warning about the dangers of nuclear winter. We had about 3 years there in the 80s when there was a global concern about nuclear winter. The idea that even a limited nuclear war would throw up so much dust and debris and smoke into the atmosphere that would block the sun's rays and kill off most, if not all, life on the planet. And then the Wall Street Journal and others started to say, well, this is really junk science, and that it would not kill everybody. Worse it would be with nuclear winter, nuclear fall, or nuclear autumn. A lot of people would die, but not everybody, as the surface of the Earth plummeted to freezing temperatures and agriculture was destroyed for a decade. What we now know is that they actually underestimated the threat of nuclear winter in the 1980s. That the threshold for nuclear winter is lower than they predicted, and the consequences are worse. The estimate now is that a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, in which 100 nuclear weapons were detonated, would create so much debris and smoke that it would create a partial nuclear winter with up to 2 billion people dying and disease, famine, plague for a decade. That's 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons they're talking about. Right now, we've got 15,000. Almost all are between 7 and 80 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb. So if a small percentage of those were detonated, the effects would be catastrophic. But does a Donald Trump understand this? Putin might understand this. And my friend Oliver Stone had interviewed Putin for a documentary recently. And I asked Oliver, did he raise this question with Putin to try to gauge Putin's level of understanding? And unfortunately, he didn't. But I would like to do so. And maybe in this next project that Oliver and I have coming up, we'll have a chance to do that, because it's crucial for people to, again, get the threat of nuclear winter back on their horizon, to understand how dangerous this is potentially, that even a limited nuclear exchange. And you look at what's going on with North Korea. I mean, Kim Jong-un is reckless. Is he irrational? We don't know. The expert opinion is very mixed on that. But he's certainly impulsive, and he doesn't even need nuclear weapons. He's got enough artillery trained on Seoul, which is one of the most densely populated cities in the world, and about 35 miles from the North Korean border. He can wipe out Seoul with the conventional artillery. We've also got over 30,000 U.S. troops there. So if he kills 10,000 U.S. troops in an attack, how does the U.S. respond? Well, we assume that Donald Trump responds by wiping out North Korea, which the United States can certainly do. So we've got all these different scenarios that are very dangerous. And you know, I went to Russia, I visited Russia four times in the year, in a little more than a year leading up to the election in November. And I was often the only one in the room who was arguing that that Russia would be better off if the United States elected a warmonger like Hillary Clinton than it would be if the United States elected a madman like Donald Trump. My Russian colleagues disagreed. They saw how dangerous Clinton was, and they were supportive of Trump. Well, I warned them that they be careful what you wish for, because Trump might seem like a more reasonable choice today based on things he's saying, but he was actually doesn't have any commitment to these ideas, could flip overnight, as he's done. Now the sentiment in Russia is that Trump is actually an enemy and highly dangerous. So, you know, and that's what I predicted. I'm sorry I was wrong. The one thing on which I preferred Trump over Clinton was that Trump did call for a friendlier relationship with Russia, working together against terrorism and collaboration where we had mutual interests. Now he's denied that. He's betrayed that vision. And now so the one thing that was potentially good about a Trump presidency has become corrosive as well.
We need to probably go back and re-examine the whole idea that behind the president and behind his advisors and the national security state is the all-encompassing fifth column, and that's the military weapons corporations. And they have over 400,000 individual or corporate contractors in Washington. They control so much lobbying, and the U.S. has voted against the United Nations' attempt to start negotiations for a worldwide nuclear warhead ban treaty, which would be similar to the current bans on landmines and biological weapons. And I think North Korea actually voted in favor of it, but I place no confidence in North Korea to make any intelligent choice. But what other treaties has the U.S. under either Obama or Trump reneged on, and what do you think is the primary motivation for the U.S. turning rogue within the international community on the issue of nuclear weapons?
Well, and it's not only the United States. You before had said that Russia would probably be willing to negotiate a reduction in nuclear arsenals. Unfortunately, right now, that's probably not true, because Russia's main claim to being a superpower is that it has almost half of the world's nuclear arsenal. So Russia had been loath to make cuts further than the New START agreement, New START treaty, which Obama did negotiate. And the other reason why Russia is so hesitant is that the United States has a vast superiority in conventional weapons. So what we really need to see is not only the UN treaty or the non-proliferation treaty being acted upon. You know, Article 6 of the NPT calls upon the original five nuclear powers to take dramatic steps to eliminate their nuclear arsenals. And that was over 40 years ago, and we haven't exactly lived up to that treaty either. But the real one that bothered the Russians was the U.S. abrogation of the ABM treaty, which occurred under George W. Bush. So what we need now is to begin to ratchet down all of the militarization that's occurring, because unless the United States is willing to cut its conventional weapons as well, I don't think Russia is going to be very open to cutting the nuclear arsenals. But that's what we need. We need to eliminate nuclear weapons globally. We need to get down to zero if we can. If we can't get down to zero, we need to get down below the threshold for nuclear winter. Okay, we can say that maybe our species doesn't have the intelligence right now to do the kinds of things that the world needs. But maybe let's at least make sure that our species continues into the future so that future generations can do the kinds of things that human beings should be doing. You have to, as we found out recently, the Oxfam study shows that the richest 8 people in the world have more wealth than the poorest 3.6 billion. Just think about that. I ask my students to think about what that means. If you came down from another planet, visited the Earth, and saw that 3.6 billion people have the same amount of wealth as 8 people. We're living at a time that's so grossly disproportionate, so irrational, as you talk about the vast amounts of money that are wasted on armaments. Back after World War I, at least the people had the wisdom to refer to the arms manufacturers as the merchants of death. There were congressional hearings, Senate hearings in the mid-1930s, the Nye Committee, which called for eliminating, basically zeroing out these arms merchants, having the state control weaponry. It's the equivalent of people profiting off illness. Now you've got people profiting off death. So these really are merchants of death, and who have an interest and a stake in war and in militarization and the military spending. There should not be anyone on the planet who's going to profit from this kind of killing. And the United States is leading the world in terms of international arms sales. One year, a few years ago, the United States was responsible for 76% of global arms sales. I don't know what the number was for last year, but it's way up there. And so this should not be something that anybody profits from.
I agree. Peter, thank you very much for being on today. We really appreciate your insights. And people can get a copy of Peter and Oliver Stone's book online or go to any bookstore. It's The Untold History of the United States, co-authored with Oliver Stone. We look forward to our next conversation, Peter.
The series is up on Netflix and iTunes. People can get it. You can actually buy the entire documentary series on Amazon for about $18, all 12 episodes. And
great.
It's pretty amazing, so I hope people do take a look at it.
I agree. Professor Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C., where he's also director of the university's Nuclear Studies Institute. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Stay tuned, because the second most popular radio program on the Progressive Radio Network, here every day at 1 p.m., the one and only Utrice Lead.